Peter Matheson was a literary legend in American 20th century writing. I sort of figure that I imagine him as a sort of Mount Rushmore in this sort of rather chiseled manner on the American landscape. He was the only author to win the National Book Award in both the fiction and non-fiction categories. He's the author of more than 30 books, among which The Snow Leopard is, of course, the one that achieved the status of a modern classic. The book is a hybrid of travel, memoir, and spiritual quest. And I suppose the key thing that Lance's book illuminates so beautifully is that Matheson was a seeker who showed as much curiosity about the spiritual world as he did about the natural world, and he was always in search of transcendence. Like George in his novel Race Rock, he was attracted to anything moving in a rhythm deeper than his own. But he was also a man with quite an ego, although he was always trying to slough that ego off like an unwanted skin. He was difficult, driven, complex. He was so many things that Lance quite rightly called his superb sweeping biography The Lives, plural, of Peter Matheson. So just to give you an idea of how I'm going to go about this, because honestly there are so many ways to skin this cat, I will not be talking about this book in any kind of chronological way. I'm going to try and cherry pick some moments and themes to give you the sort of amplitude and complexity of the character that is Peter. So let's just start with a sort of few questions about him and about you. Most of us have never met you before, including me. Your previous biography was about a flamboyant Savile Row tailor to the stars.
Yeah.
You first heard about Tommy Nutter at a party. Why was he interesting enough for you to write a book about him?
The story behind that book is a whole saga. So I originally moved to the US in 2013 with the plan of writing a book about wolves, actually. I was interested in the American Grey Wolf as kind of a symbol that people pour all these sorts of ideas into. And I wanted to sort of unpack this symbol. And I spent a couple of years working on this project. And then wrote this enormous proposal, took it to a publisher, and a month before I did that, someone sold a book about wolves for, I think, like $1 million or something. So this project that I've been working on for years kind of died very quickly. And I found myself adrift and not really sure what I was doing. And yes, I was at a party and a friend told me about this tailor on Savile Row, and I kind of just grabbed hold of it. It was like a lifeline. And wrote this book, but I'm really proud of that book, and I learned a lot, and it evolved in ways I could never have expected. But I sort of consider this book kind of a homecoming to the things that really mattered to me.
So you got back to the wolves.
There are wolves in the book. Yeah, there are wolves. I go back to like nature and anthropology and sort of travel and things like that, that it were kind of my passion. So yeah, the Nutter book is kind of an anomaly for me in my sort of career and interests.
Now it's at another party. I'm seeing that as a biographer, it's important to go to parties.
I don't go to that many parties anymore. I think they're all in my past.
But, it turns out that at another party, you met Alex Matheson. You met one
I did.
Of Peter Matheson's children.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's one thing to meet someone at a party, but how does that then become a book?
So Alex Matheson, if you've read The Snow Leopard, Alex Matheson in The Snow Leopard is an 8-year-old boy, actually 9 years old. Peter gets the age wrong. And it says a lot right there about him and his children. He gets his son's age wrong. But in this book, he's a young boy and he's writing his father's letters in the Himalayas. So I had read this book, countless times. And then I meet Alex at a party and I just like couldn't get over the fact that it seems stupid in retrospect that he had aged and that he was not this 8-year-old boy. In fact, he was in his late 50s or early 60s. But he was very gracious and lovely, and we talked, and I told him, how much this book had meant to me. So I had it in the back of my mind that I knew him. I had a conduit to the family. But when I finished my first book and was thinking about what to do next, I remembered something that a writing teacher once told me, that if you can talk yourself out of an idea for a book, you shouldn't do it. It means that you don't have the commitment. You should only ever write about things that cannot get out of your mind, that you're totally obsessed with. I think a lot of writers would agree with that. So I had a whole list of ideas and I talked myself out of every one of them except for something about Matheson and this book, The Snow Leopard. And I didn't actually contact Alex. I contacted Peter's widow, Maria, and I went out to see her. I remember it was November 2017. She lives in the Hamptons. And I was really quite nervous because Maria is famously formidable to the point where there's a This American... Is anyone familiar with the podcast This American Life? There's actually a podcast about Maria Matheson because her daughter is Sarah Koenig, the serial journalist. So Sarah had made a podcast about the eight things you're not supposed to talk to my mother about. And they're kind of a list of subjects that if you raise them in her presence, she gets very terse and upset. And I had listened to this podcast and I remembered that, you know, Robert Redford had once gone out and then talked about the directions that he took to get to the house. And then he was dead to her. She never wanted to see Robert Redford again. So I was quite nervous about meeting Maria. And I went out there and she, you know, we sat down and she's from Tanzania, but she sounds very British and she's very proper. And she poured the tea and she was correcting my grammar the whole time. But she was really lovely. And she gave me her blessing, but she told me she didn't want to be part of the book. She wanted nothing to do with it because they had had a very complicated marriage and she didn't know me. But that was sort of where it started. And I sort of said, okay, Maria, you don't have to be part of it, but I'm going to do this thing. And I went away and started to write it. And then Alex came in sort of a little later then.
We may or may not come back to Robert Redford. He does appear later on in the
story.
But I just wonder, you know, once you've got the sort of sign-off or the blessing or semi-blessing and approval of Maria, and there are two previous wives that we may or may not get to as well, he treated them all appallingly. That's the blanket statement we can make.
He did.
Once you've got the blessing of a key member of the family like that, know that no one else is embarking on the same pursuit, because I have come across biographers, I think we all know some biographers who have started working on something and found out that someone else is doing it too. Is it possible for a family to give their blessing to many people and just see who survives?
I mean, I certainly that could happen. I think with the Mathesons, there were other people interested in him at that stage, but I sold the project and they saw that it was a serious thing. And I think that once that kind of had eventuated, they sort of cut off every other flower. I don't know what every other thing sort of. So once they saw what I was doing, they kind of gave their blessing, but it was not authorized. It wasn't like they needed to read the book before it got published. There was never anything like that. I did let them read it before it got published just for factual reasons. And I remember Maria read it. We'll talk about Maria, but she read it, and you know, there's all sorts of stuff in this book that is so devastating about her marriage with him. And she read it, and then she said to me, she called me, she read it in like a day, and it's a big book. And she said, "There's one thing I really need you to change." And I said, "Maria, what is it? Like anything? There's stuff in this book about your mother killing herself. Like what is it?" And she said, "You know, you described the bookshelf in his room as tall, but it was actually a short bookshelf. And I just think you need to fix this." And I was like, "Okay, Maria, sure. Fine, I'll fix the bookshelf, but nothing else." Yeah.
Do you really believe she read it in a day, or do you think she skipped to the bits about her?
No, I think she read it in a day. I mean, she stayed awake. She read it. Yep. Okay. Yep. And then she read it again. Yep.
Impressive. I want to know, just back to you for a moment. Mm. You're Australian.
Mm-hmm.
Neither of your subjects so far.
Yeah.
Australian. How did you fall into biography and end up where you were?
Yeah, I mean, I never sort of saw myself as a biographer. I don't really see myself as a biographer even now. I went to the US in 2013 to do a graduate degree at NYU in literary journalism, like long form journalism for the New Yorker, that type of writing. And it just so happened that I fell into biography. When I wrote my first book, which is technically a biography, I didn't see it that way as I was writing it. And then with this one, obviously it is kind of a straight biography, but, it was never kind of a conscious choice. It just sort of happened. And I have kind of mixed feelings about biography as a genre. I think it's a complicated form. Yeah.
Hang on, say more about that.
Yeah, it can be very invasive. I think a lot of biographies aren't very good. I think it's very hard to write a good one. I don't know. I don't know, I just have ambivalent feelings about biography.
That's interesting, because I think one of the problems with biography for me is that it's a very privileged sphere, because mm-hmm. it's so expensive.
Yeah, it is. It is.
It's the number of people
right.
who can do it.
Right.
So often it becomes a sort of white middle class endeavor
yeah.
because those are the people who can afford it.
Right, right. That is true.
So then they tell the stories, you know,
yeah,
through that lens.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. I mean, I was having a conversation yesterday about why there isn't more biography in Australia. And I think it does come down to resources and what is available. And like, I would love to write about, I tried to pitch a book about Ludwig Leichhardt. I would love to write a book about Ludwig Leichhardt. But I couldn't get the support to do that. And I just don't, you know, the only way I could write this book was to get a series of fellowships that unfortunately don't exist here. So it's tough.
Which is yeah. why it's so sad that the Hazel Rowley Fellowship...
Yeah, this is the last year, I know. Yeah.
...will not exist going forward. I was going to ask you about how you organize... I mean, that because there are so many writers in the audience, I know that they will be interested in method and process as much as in the life of. So I'm going to try and sort of toggle between the two. I read the other day that you had over 800 files.
8,000.
8,000.
Yeah.
Just missing a note there. About Peter Matheson. So can you just explain, is your research existing in both analog form and digital form? You know, what are you doing? How are you organizing it? Do you have a timeline? What's on your wall?
Yeah, yeah. No, so I everything's digital. I had very little actual paper. So I go into the archive. His archive is in Texas. I moved to Texas. Never again. Never again. I lived there for 2 years, and I went into the archive every day. And for 11 months of those 2 years, there was a pandemic in the middle of that. And I would scan everything. And then I would go home, and I would log it all in Evernote. And I had tags, and it was very OCD and organized. And I also had a timeline of his life that was a Word document. And everything I would find, I would summarize into the Word document. So you could look at this Word document for like... July 1977, and every letter that he sent that month and everything he did was summarized in this. So that was the way I kind of dealt with this enormous amount of material and made it sort of manageable. And then when it came time to write, I knew what each chapter was, sort of what part of his life it was dealing with. And I would print out just that section of the timeline. And that would be the key that I would use to get to the files that I needed to get to. And so you just kind of have to, like, you know, I spent years doing that, doing nothing but kind of basically populating an archive. And then once I had done that, I was able to kind of shrink it down and shrink it down. So I didn't have this enormous amount of material. I was only ever dealing with little bits. Yeah.
You mentioned Maria, and obviously she is really crucial in terms of the approval and her participation and that aspect of the story. But was there anyone else who refused to talk to you or who really required a lot of coaxing over years?
So I should say about Maria, so, you know, she, as I said before, she didn't initially want to talk to me because, you know, why would she conduct an autopsy on with someone she didn't know? But what would happen is I would go and see her. She's very gracious and lovely. And I would go and see her to scan photos out of the photo albums. She had all the photo albums lined up. And as we were doing this, she would be pumping me for information basically about her late husband because he had not told her anything. So she would be asking me questions about things that she didn't know in his life. And we did this for like 4 years. And after about 4 years of me visiting her and just talking to her about his previous wives and everything, she called me one day and she said, okay, I see that you are doing a good job, or you're doing, you know, you're doing this properly. So I've decided to talk to you. And so I went out and we sat down and we had a very candid conversation. And because we had taken us 4 years to get to that point, we were at the point where I could say to her, why didn't you ever leave him? And I don't think I would have said that to a woman that I didn't know that well. You know, it took 4 years to get to that point, but it meant that by the time we got there, I was able to ask those really kind of invasive questions. And she told me everything. And then at the end of this conversation, she said, you know, all his papers had gone down to Texas, but she had held back her papers and they were under her bed in boxes. And she gave me everything. And she said, okay, I trust you. And these were all of the, if you read the book, there's incredibly painful letters in there about him having affairs and treating her badly. And they are all the letters that were under her bed. And as much as possible, I got out of the way and I just let her speak in the book and have her word. But that took 4 years. So it was the long game. The person that was hardest to pin down actually was Alex, because he just was like a, like a little snake, and he just kept slipping out of my grasp. He was so, so impossible to pin down. And it took like 5 years to actually get him to sit down for an interview. Not because he kept saying to me, oh, we'll do it, we'll do it, we'll do it. But for a while he was talking about writing something himself, and I think he was holding back a little bit. And then eventually it kind of got to crunch, and I said, okay, Alex, like, you either talk to me or I'm just going to write you out of this book. And, like, obviously you'll be in it, but like, you know, not very much. And then he sat down and we had a very, like, a 4-hour conversation, and yeah, but he was actually the hardest one. Mm, yeah.
Interesting story.
Yeah.
Peter Matheson did make notes for a memoir.
He
what
did.
Happened to those notes, and to what extent was he self-aware?
So he was writing notes for a memoir when he died, and they were on his hard drive, which Maria gave me his hard drive. And there was about 24,000 words, 22,000 words of notes, but they're notes. They're like fragments. They're not really anything you could publish. And there are parts in that are certainly self-aware. There's some comments in there about the way he treated his first wife that I think if he had been able to kind of, what he wrote in those notes at the time, maybe it wouldn't have gone as badly as it did. So he had, you know, had the self-reflection with time, but a lot of the stuff that, you know, to do with Maria and everything, he didn't get to in the notes, because that's later in his life. And I'm not sure he would have had the self-awareness anyway, because I don't think he thought he did anything wrong.
No.
Yeah. Or he did think he did something wrong, but then just thought he'd kind of atoned for it in the moment. Whereas everyone else sort of differently.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I'm curious about an issue of waiting, and this is a kind of craft issue, I suppose. I mean, this is a big book. It's about 700 pages. How do you decide how much weight you're going to give to childhood and family history and the sort of backstory before he sort of strides onto the stage?
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, there's a fascinating quote of his that you pick up, which is him saying in that memoir, in those notes, I've been angry since I was about 8.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to talk about what that anger might have been and what that was as fuel for the rest of his persona. But how do you decide I'm going to give, you know, a third to his life in his 20s, up to his 20s?
Yeah.
Are you doing it like that? Are you thinking in terms of chunks of time, body of work?
Yeah. No, I think a lot of biographies do this thing where they say like every chapter is 5 years, right? And then so you sort of foot march through time. And I think that's kind of deadening on the page, because it just gets very like, and then this happened, then this happened, then this happened. So I knew that when I sort of set out to write this book, I wanted it to be each chapter to be almost like a self-contained episode with a beginning and a middle and an end. So one chapter in the book covers 20 months and another chapter covers nearly 20 years, because that's how long that episode took. So I had a sense of the whole thing before I wrote any of it, about like, you know, what the chapter breakdown was going to be. And it evolved as I wrote, but I kind of had a rough idea. And in terms of like how much weight to give to sort of, you know, the background and things, you know, a lot of biographies have hundreds of pages of just like his ancestors, and I have a little bit of it, but I just put as much in as interested me. And then if I got bored, I didn't put it in. You know, if he had a pretty colorful ancestry, and it's sort of fun, I thought it was fun to read about. So I put in just enough of that to give you an idea of the money that he came from and things like that. But then no more, because then it just gets boring.
Just go back to that anger quote. Angry since I was about 8. That's one hell of a statement.
Yeah, yeah. So he was a WASP. A white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, and from a very privileged background. And he would tell it to everyone, about being about 8 years old and being on Fisher's Island, which is an island off the coast of Connecticut, not far from where I live, actually. And it's sort of an enclave of very wealthy white people. And his family had a house there, and there was a beach and that they owned and everything. And at about the age of 8, his father collected him and his brother and sister and took them out on a little boat and wanted to see how their swimming lessons were going, and told them to jump out and swim. But he had stopped in a place where there was sort of just ambiguous shapes under the boat, and Peter was very scared of this. So he refused to jump. And so his father picked him up and threw him overboard. And as he got thrown overboard, Peter hit his arm on the boat as he went down, and then he came up swearing at his father, which was not okay. So he got punished really badly for that. And I don't know how much of it is actually kind of true and how much of it is a novelist choosing this moment that he remembered from his childhood and investing a lot of power in it, you know, retroactively. But he saw this as kind of the beginning of the war between him and his parents, that his father had betrayed him. I think there was certainly some truth in that because, you know, he's doing LSD 30 years later and he's feeling phantom pains in his arm because of this thing. So it definitely haunted him. But yeah, he had a very complicated relationship with his family.
He did.
Yeah.
If we jump forward in time, and again, this is a process thing about you. The most significant trip that you made for this book was obviously going to be the trip to the Himalayas to go to the Crystal Mountains, which is where the Snow Leopard story is sort of rooted or earthed, I suppose. So you go to the Himalayas. Can you describe the journey that you planned, which I believe it was years in the planning?
Yeah.
And can you then tell us what happened?
Yeah. So I'd read this book, The Snow Leopard, years ago because a friend who's sitting here, right there, all your fault, Gemma. Gemma gave me a copy of The Snow Leopard like 17 years ago or something crazy like that and told me to read this book. And it really struck me. So it's about an expedition that Matheson took in 1973 with a field biologist named George Schaller to a place called the Crystal Monastery in Nepal. And they were going there to look at the Himalayan blue sheep or the Baral to study this animal in its natural habitat. But for Matheson, he was also getting over the death of his second wife. And he was also a new student of Zen Buddhism. So it had like this sort of spiritual dimension as well. And I was really, I love this book so much. And I knew that when I took this project on, I wanted to recreate this journey. And it was in the proposal that I was going to do this. And it was a little bit of like faking it till you make, like, I had no idea I was going to do this. And you know, it's not in a part of Nepal that you can just walk to, like just go to. There's no tours that go there. So I sort of sold this book and then thought, oh, okay, now I need to actually pull this off. And it took me a couple of years to figure out how to do it. And I found a Scotsman, Gavin Anderson, who runs a nonprofit trekking company that works with local communities, including in this part of Nepal called Dolpo. And I sent him a message and it was just sort of I just wanted some advice about how to do this. And then Gavin, I think he regretted it later, but he said, I'll take you, we'll go. So we mounted a private expedition. So it was Gavin, me, a photographer named James Appleton, and then we had a couple of local guys who came with us, and we had five mules. And we set out to recreate, not the entire Snow Leopard expedition, because part of it, if you read the book now, the first part that they do from Pokhara is now kind of, there's a freeway there. So it's not very good. So we kind of flew in and then picked it up. And we walked for about three weeks to the Crystal Monastery. And I got very sick when we were there. And I got the onset of pulmonary edema and we had to evacuate pretty quickly.
It's kind of a fatal condition.
Yeah, it wasn't great.
To the middle of nowhere. How do you get out of the middle of nowhere quickly?
Walking. You have to walk. Yeah. I mean, we had to walk, and if it got worse, we would have to get a helicopter and that would be bad. But I was coughing uncontrollably. I couldn't stop coughing and there was blood in my nose and all sorts of things. But we were there at the monastery for 24 hours. And for that 24 hours, so I wanted to go there partly because I just loved this book and wanted to redo it and have an adventure. But I also wanted to go there because Matheson had this idea in his life of what he called the island, which was not necessarily a physical island, but it was a place where he could go and kind of like shed the encrustations of ego and identity and all of the things that society puts on us and just be like his original self, like a childlike being. And for him, this place in the Himalayas was the place that he had felt that he got closest to that. And I didn't expect to get that myself, but I just wanted to kind of go and see this place that he felt that he'd found this sort of moment of sort of ego death or whatever you call it. And even though we're only there for 24 hours, it was so extraordinary, this place, and just sort of so elemental that I felt like it gave me an insight that I was then able to carry out and write about in the book and understand his sort of spiritual evolution with much more conviction than I think I would have been able to without it. But we had to get out there pretty quickly. And then after we got out, you know, my health improved. And then about a month afterwards, I get an email from Gavin saying, basically, he said, I don't want to alarm you, but James has had an incident. He was in Armenia and James when he had gotten back, he got back, he had giardia and he was taking pills for it. And apparently, so maybe it wasn't a month, maybe it was a couple of weeks or a week or two or something. And the pills had upset the giant tapeworm that he had also picked up in Dolpo, which then evacuated his body in a David Cronenberg-like scene, just came out. And so Gavin's like, so you might just want to go get checked. Because, you know, we were eating all the same food. And I went and got checked and did not have a tapeworm, thank God, but I did have another microscopic parasite that I had to do like a nuclear bomb of antibiotics to get rid of. So we came back with souvenirs. But I'd do it all again. It was amazing.
We've had a snake and now we've got a tapeworm. Where are we going? To what extent, Lance, I mean, how much do you feel that you have to go full method as a biographer? So you go to the Crystal Mountain, you studied Zen, you went and did some fairly hard, intensive Zen study so that you could understand some of the philosophy.
I don't want to oversell that. I did like a week of Zen.
Quite hard, quite...
I would say very uncomfortable. If anyone's ever done Zazen, you sit on your knees for hours at a time. Yeah, I didn't love it. Yeah.
No, so for example, there's a period of Peter's life which is very invested in exploring psychotropic drugs, particularly ingesting large quantities of LSD.
Mm-hmm.
Did you go there?
No, I didn't do LSD. No, no, because I would do it. I just didn't have the opportunity to do that. Yeah. But no, I would do that. Yeah, sure. I don't know if for the method thing, I just don't know how else to do it. I don't do anything in half measure. If I'm going to write this book, I want to do the absolute best I can do. And that means doing all of these things. And it means turning every page, like Robert Caro says in the archives. So I therefore, of course, had to move there and do this. And I just don't know how else to do it. And yeah, so I don't see it as going method. It's just the only way I know how. Yeah.
I want to ask you for a moment about a time in his life that there's been a lot of sort of contentious conversation around.
Oh, dear.
Co-founding the Paris Review.
Oh, I thought you were going to say something about Bigfoot, but okay.
No, we're going to come to Bigfoot.
Okay, right.
Don't worry. Bigfoot, I'm saving for later.
Okay, all right.
The Paris Review, he's the co-founder with George Plimpton of the Paris Review, and it turns out that this role is actually a cover for an entirely different kind of work. Can you just talk to us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so Peter was at Yale, and his English professor, Norman Holmes Pearson, pulled him aside one day and said, yeah, basically, do you want to do something for your country? And this is how Peter got recruited into the CIA. And this is 1950, so this is before the CIA was doing coups and all sorts of things. And so Peter said yes, not because he was driven ideologically or, you know, terribly cared about any of this sort of thing. But he said yes because they were offering to let him and his new wife live in Paris, which was a city that Peter loved. And they would give him a stipend so that Peter could go there and write the great American novel that he wanted to write. So Peter just saw it as like an excuse to go back to Paris, really, and someone pay him to be there. But while he was there, you know, he was doing what he was doing for the CIA, and it's not entirely clear because the CIA would not give me anything, and Peter was always kind of cagey about what he was doing. But essentially, I think he was spying on expats, including his friends, and sort of, you know, looking at other sort of communists in Paris and things like that. But while he was there, you know, the labor of a writer is quite invisible to people outside. It doesn't look like most of the time that we're not doing anything. We're just sort of standing there or sitting there. And it started to become a liability that Peter's job was not visible. It didn't look like he had a job. So his mind had told him that he needed to do something a bit more visible as a cover, that his novel was not enough. So he had met another American, you know, this was a lot of Americans at this time in Paris. And he met Harold Doc Humes, who was sort of involved with little magazines and was running one called the Paris News Post that wasn't very good. And Peter came on board for a little while, but then said, why don't we just get rid of this crappy magazine and start a new one and start like a, do a good one, do a good job. But he didn't want to edit it. So he called up a friend who was living in London, in Cambridge at the time, George Plimpton. And George came over and they very famously founded the Paris Review, which is still going. But Peter, all the while behind the scenes, you know, unbeknownst to all of his friends, all these editors, was still doing stuff for the CIA. And there's been so much talk over the years and so much focus on the idea of whether the CIA was secretly funding the Paris Review as part of this sort of cultural Cold War. And it's impossible to fully discount that, although I'm pretty skeptical of it based on the evidence. But I think a much more interesting question is, what was Peter doing that he needed the cover? And he left behind memoir notes about that too. And he got introduced to this man who, in his memoir notes, he calls Monsieur X. He doesn't identify him. I think it may have been Tristan Tzara. I don't know for sure. But he met this man, and he would sit with him in the cafes in Montparnasse, and essentially he was trying to pump him. This guy was very prominent in the French Communist Party, the PCF, and Peter's job was to get information from him about how it worked. So he had to come up with a way to get the information out, and it sounds ridiculous, but this is apparently what he did, what he claims to have done. He came up with an idea of a novel about communists in Paris, and he would sit there and he would tell this guy about this novel, and the guy would give him advice about how to make the novel more realistic. And this is how he was pumping him for information. And so this went on for a while, and Peter says his CIA minders were very excited about the intel he was getting, and they eventually wanted him to actually join the Communist Party and become a mole. But at the same time that was happening, his wife was pregnant and people were listening on his phones and he was being followed, so she panicked and he wanted nothing to do with it, so he quit and pulled out. And in the same month he pulls out, quits, his son is born, and the Paris Review debuts. All happened at once, very dramatic. And then, you know, a couple of months later, he's in Italy with the Styrons, William Styron, Rose Styron, on their honeymoon, as you do. And he tells Bill about this fake novel about communists in Paris. And Bill's like, you should finish that. Sounds great. Styron has no idea that it's a CIA kind of project. So Peter did finish it, and it's Partisans. His second novel started life as a CIA project. And no one knew that until I read these documents, and the novel's terrible. It's dreadful, dreadful novel, but it's kind of an interesting story. Yeah.
So can I just speculate with you for a moment about something that's just occurred to me?
Yeah.
Do you think that in a way, to expiate any guilt that he might have felt about that entire episode, do you think that that's behind the motivation for writing the biography of Cesar Chavez, who is an activist on the left with the
farm workers union,
fighting the agribusiness in California?
Yeah.
Do you think that's an expiation?
I don't know so much about Cesar Chavez, who he was kind of largely responsible for helping Chavez get such a significant public profile, because he wrote a series of profiles of him for The New Yorker. I definitely think it was partly behind Matheson's involvement with the American Indian movement and Leonard Peltier. And I know that he was very worried later on about the idea that Leonard would learn that he had been a CIA agent at some point, because, you know, quite rightly, people in the American Indian movement were very, very chary of the FBI, because the FBI was trying to infiltrate them. If anyone's ever heard of COINTELPRO, like these sort of basically agent provoker, you know what I'm saying. And so they were very worried about the FBI, and Peter was worried about them learning that he had previously been a CIA agent. So
before we get to Leonard Peltier, because I think that is one of the most engrossing parts of his life and of the way you tell the story, because it is very complicated and very factual.
Yeah, it was horrible.
Do you recall Peter admitting to himself at any stage on any journey, for example, the journey in the Amazon, which is another very big and significant journey in his life, do you recall him ever experiencing feeling out of his depth or feeling afraid? Because I don't get a sense much of this man having a great deal of fear, say physically or psychologically.
No, I think there's definitely moments. I mean, he went on a very famous expedition in 1961 to what at that time was Netherlands, New Guinea, is now West Papua. And he was in the Balian Valley. If anyone's ever seen an anthropological film called Dead Birds, it's very interesting, very problematic, but very interesting. And Matheson was there. And I know that he was scared then, and he wrote poetry about it, very bad poetry, but about being kind of feeling like he was going to die. And there were moments, so he was sort of very prone to depression. So there's definitely moments of little like hesitation. He was depressed in the Serengeti, which kind of sounds very funny, like to be depressed in the Serengeti. But so there were definitely moments where
he's depressed there with a very good reason, which is that he's seeing the impact that man is having on the natural environment.
Yeah.
And he's feeling terribly helpless.
His marriage was also falling apart. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So this is where Robert Redford comes in. So we're back to Leonard Peltier, because I do think this story is very important. Mm. It certainly was not one that I knew.
Mm.
This is really the quintessential moment for Matheson in terms of justice advocacy and where he can put his writing power to use and try and affect change. So can you just explain what Leonard Peltier was accused of?
Yeah, I mean, he wasn't just accused. He was prosecuted, incarcerated for it. So in 1975... there was a shootout on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota between FBI agents, but then like, you know, basically the entire forces of the United States, and the American Indian Movement, members of the American Indian Movement at this place called the Jumping Bull property, which I went to and I walked around the crime scene and everything. And during the shootout, two FBI agents were quite brutally executed by somebody, point blank range, just shot in the head and killed. And no one has ever definitively proved who actually did this, but there was at the time a couple of suspects, and the FBI and the DA, everyone else, kind of came after these people, but they all got off because their evidence wasn't strong enough. The only person that didn't get off was Leonard Peltier, because he was a fugitive at the time in Canada. So he was extradited, and because they had run out of anyone else to prosecute, they just put all of their weight on prosecuting Leonard, even though the evidence really didn't stack up. And, they basically railroaded him into prison. And Matheson initially, when he learned about this, didn't initially necessarily think Leonard was guilty or innocent, had no idea, but was very confident that Leonard had not got a fair trial. And all he was doing, all Peter was doing, was he wanted Leonard to have a fair trial. So he wrote this book. He initially didn't want to write it. He wanted a native writer to write it, but no one else would do it. So he wrote this book called In the Spirit of Crazy Horse, this enormous book about the American Indian Movement and Leonard Peltier and all sorts of things. And he ended up being sued for $49 million because of this book, because he got two libel suits against him. And it stretched on for years, and it was a whole saga. But
Redford is peripheral in that story, in that he expresses an interest in telling the story.
Yeah,
he's too slow to do it, and so becomes very annoyed with him.
Yeah, I put in a footnote where he's like dressing down Robert Redford in a letter, which is like, who does that? Wow. Where he's kind of mad at Robert Redford because he's sort of umming and ahhing about whether he's going to do this project. But, you know, Redford also went and saw Leonard in prison and was able to kind of just swan in because of who he was. And then Matheson, you know, really had to fight to get access, even though he was the one actually writing the book. I spoke to Leonard while he was in prison. That was an unusual interaction. So until Biden last January gave him executive clemency. So until then, Leonard was in prison for 46 years or something, I think. And now he's at home. He's got an armchair. He sits in his armchair back on the Turtle Mountain Reservation in North Dakota, where he lives under house arrest. But I sent him a letter, and I didn't really expect a response, because you sort of send a letter into the American prison system, it's like dropping it into a well. You have no idea. And he called me at like 7 a.m. on a Sunday morning, and it was an unlisted number, or a number that I didn't even pick up the first few times, and then I eventually picked up, and then he was just like, "Hello, it's Leonard," and I was like, "Oh, okay, hello." And then we exchanged emails through this program called CauseLink, which is like a prison email system. But it was very interesting interacting with him, because you know, everything's read, everything's monitored. The American prison system is not great. Yeah.
No, but
many things in America right now, not great.
At that cause, he did not
to the very end of his life, Peter was going to the White House, talking to Clinton, talking to anyone that would listen to him.
Yeah. Clinton for a pardon.
Yeah.
It looked like he was going to get it.
Yeah, and then didn't give it. Oh, no. So I think I was really actually, that was a last minute edit. So my book was already laid out on the page and already in proofs when that executive clemency came through. And I had enough time just to go in and add a footnote that he had gotten executive clemency. And I really loved that I could kind of have that resolution to Leonard's story. And I think Peter would be really thrilled that happened.
The notes in this book are so juicy that they almost are like little sort of novels or short stories in themselves.
Yeah.
It's very, very... You're on a par with Oliver Sacks when it comes to footnotes, I have to tell you.
Oh, Oliver Sacks. Gosh.
Sophie, because we started a few minutes late, I hope you don't mind if we're just going to go a couple of minutes extra, because really now I want to address the Bigfoot in the room.
Great.
So when Peter Matheson is in the Himalayas, he obviously, I suppose obviously, becomes interested in the phenomenon of the Yeti.
Mm-hmm.
And then... there is the phenomenon of Bigfoot in the Native American Indian culture.
Yes.
Creatures. I don't really know what to make of how to understand Peter Matheson's fascination with this notion.
Mm.
And I want to ask you what you think Yeti / Bigfoot represents for Peter.
Yeah.
Is it another version of a snow leopard? And was he gullible?
I mean, that's a great question. Was he gullible? I don't think he was gullible. I mean, the challenge I faced when I realized, you know, I kind of knew that he was interested in the Yeti because it's in the snow leopard, but he'd never really published about the Bigfoot. And it wasn't until I went to the archive and realized that there were like 16 boxes of material that I was going to have to confront this. And I was really nervous about it because how do you write about something so... these days so sort of comical in a way that doesn't derail the book. But, you know, he was interested in it in the early 70s when it was a very different time, when, you know, serious people like George Shaler were open to the idea that there might be undiscovered hominids in the forest and in the mountains and things like that. So Matheson initially was interested in it in the same way that he was interested in all sorts of sort of extinct animals that may still exist and then were found to exist. So it did start from a place of science. And he initially went on the New Yorker's dime to the woods of Northern California to find this thing. But then over time, it did sort of drift more into like Native American spiritual beliefs. And so it starts in a place of science and then it ends in some very out there places with like Hopi prophecies of the apocalypse and things like that. So I when I wrote it, I was like, how am I going to deal with this? Okay, I'll just take it one step at a time and lead the reader in the same way that Peter was led to this kind of pretty extreme place.
But there is a photograph in the book of
sort
of creature, and that photograph is risible.
Well, so that photograph is from the very famous Patterson Gimlin Bigfoot film, which everyone's probably seen, of that thing walking in the woods. I mean, yeah, it looks risible to us, but it's never been disproven. It actually hasn't. I mean, it's still, a lot of people still believe that that's real. He believed it. So it's a weird part of his life that I kind of had to deal with, but it was not my favorite part of the process, that's for sure.
So,
yeah.
So it's on the cusp, I suppose, of fact and fiction. And
there
seems to be a lot of tension in Peter's own mind about always being seen first and foremost as a writer of nonfiction, whereas he wanted to be appreciated as a novelist. In terms of the body of work, which you give us a beautiful sort of analysis of each book, which book of his do you think, apart from The Snow Leopard, which we'll just park there as a classic, which book of his do you think is most overlooked and that we should go back and revisit, or which is your favorite?
I think it was Far Tortuga. So he wrote this book about turtle fishermen in the Cayman Islands, and initially started as a project for the New Yorker, where he went and he basically sailed on the last of these turtle voyages and wrote this piece for the New Yorker about what it was like to be on this, you know, final voyage of this ship when they were hunting green turtles. But he felt when he wrote this piece that he wasn't able to capture really the essence of the experience. So he wrote this novel, and it's kind of hard to explain what it looks like on the page. It's kind of like the words are scattered across the page. It almost looks like concrete poetry or something. And it's written in a very unusual style because he wanted to capture the spareness of the experience. So he was inspired at the time by Japanese sumi kind of, you know, the black where those paintings, it's just as much about what's not on the page as what is on the page. The white space is just as important as the black lines. And it's a really beautiful book that is very strange and takes a while to get into. You almost have to learn how to read it. But I think it's amazing and overlooked. And
because I think you've got a soft spot for wildlife in America.
I mean, I like that too. Yeah. I mean, I like a lot of his books, but wildlife in America is dated in a lot of ways. A lot of the nonfiction books have dated because that's what happens to nonfiction. But for me, it'd be Far Tortuga. Yeah.
Okay. I've got a million more questions, but I think it's your turn. So if you've got a question for Lance, we will come to you with a microphone. But while you're thinking about that, oh, shut up. That's ridiculous. Can I just ask you what spending 8 years in the company of Peter Matheson and the wives and the children and everybody else in the sort of ecosystem of Matheson, what's that done for you and to you, do you think?
Oh, gosh, that's a hard question. I mean, just on the level of writing, one would hope you get better over 8 years. I definitely took, you know, Peter was very good about looking very closely and paying very close attention to his surroundings and kind of being very good with precise details. And I definitely sort of think that I have absorbed that from him, about my writing and being very attentive to, you know, the little details around you, like the texture of the dirt under your feet. Like he's amazing. You read The Snow Leopard, it's amazing at the precision and kind of clarity. So I definitely think I learned a lot from him about the craft of writing in that regard.
I think one of the things that strikes me at the moment, I'm reading that book at the moment, is that there's this complete sensorial immersion, so that he's not just noticing, as you're saying, the ground under his feet, but he's noticing the air rushing past, any sound in a valley,
right?
Every color is brighter, but it's every sense is engaged.
Yeah, absolutely. And he's amazing at that. So I definitely absorbed that from him. I also just, you know, in terms of being able to write something like this, I never could have imagined that I could have done it. When I sold this project, it was meant to be 300 pages and finished in 2019, I think. That's what the contract said. So, you know, I look at it now and, yeah, if you told me 8 years ago that it was going to be this, I don't think I would have had the courage to take it on.
No, it's better
yeah.
to know.
Yeah.
If you've got a question, we'll bring the microphone to you. She said, go on. Great.
Thank you.
And then we'll come to you.
Lost biography is written after the subject dies. Didn't meet Peter, did you?
No, I never met him, no.
I'm going to ask you a question that Caroline asked me in her podcast about my Elizabeth Harrower biography, which has made me think a lot. If you could talk to Peter Matheson, what question would you like to ask him?
I do have a question that I would like. It's so stupid, and everyone probably like think it's just completely meaningless, but I want to know his code name when he was in the CIA. And I don't know why it's so, I was so fixated on it. For years I was trying to find it, and I know that he had a name, like an operating name over there, and I just want to know what it is.
What sort of code names do they have? Are they like Operation Epic Fury?
No, he would have a name. It would be like a name. And so like Peter Matheson, but a different name. And I just want to know what it is. And it would change nothing in the book, and it would be one edition of a line, but I just want to know what it is. Yeah.
Another fabulous footnote.
Yeah. So that's the question.
Yeah. Thank you. Hi, that's my name, Seymour Olsen.
Can you just put up your hand? I'm not. Okay, right. Hi.
Could you tell us a little bit more about your process in terms of your daily routine? Did you get up at 5 in the morning?
No, my God. No. Oh gosh, my routine. How do I fight off the despair? That's mostly what the routine is. It depends what part of the process I was in. When I was writing, if the writing was going well, I would get up and kind of go straight to my desk and just work for a couple of hours. In the morning, and then take the afternoon off to read and do other things. If the writing wasn't going well, I would write at 5 in the afternoon because I would spend the whole day putting it off. And I'm not one of those people that has like a writing routine where I write from these hours and then it's kind of just however I'm feeling on the day. That's not a very good answer, but unfortunately I don't have a routine. I don't know how I get anything done. I spend so much time not doing anything.
Elsa?
Hi.
Hello. I'm curious, when you immerse to the degree you have time, did you have two periods of caring for him and not caring for him?
Oh, yeah.
Can you just talk about that relationship? Because in the last few days, particularly with the character who's as,
And I think that's, yeah, when I went into this project, I you know, I was kind of in awe of him, and now I would say I have huge admiration for him as an artist, maybe more than I ever did, but I'm very ambivalent about him as a person. And whenever I was writing about his process or his craft or his, you know, him as a writer, you know, unalloyed admiration. But when it came to the more personal stuff, especially around Maria, because we became friends, I did struggle because he's awful in some of his interactions with people in this. But really, I guess the redeeming thing, the reason I'd always push on, is that he did recognize, he kept doing it again and again. So he was kind of like ultimately just so flawed, but he did recognize in the moment that he was awful, and he did try and apologize and atone. So he was always trying to be better, and that was the part of the Zen thing too, is that he recognized that he was this incredibly broken person and didn't want to be that and did want to be better. So that kind of redeemed him. If he just would treat people badly and then not even recognize that he'd done it, I think I would have struggled even more than I did. But yeah, I mean, and he's
so much of his cruelty in terms of his casual.
Yeah.
It's just so offhand. It's a kind of neglect or an absolute.
And taking for granted as well. Yes. And just, you know, of course, Maria's at home running everything and I don't have to be there because that's her job. It was really important to me. So when I was writing this book in the early stages, there was a biography, some of you may be familiar with it, about Philip Roth that came out. Mm-hmm. It was kind of very controversial because of the writer of that book and things that he had done or been alleged to do. But I remember reading a lot of the reviews of this book and them taking the writer to task for really siding with Roth against the women and everything he did. And I read that and I don't think I would ever have done that with Peter anyway, but it just made me even more conscious to really, when I was writing about the wives or the girlfriends, to really sort of just let them have the spotlight and have their say and as much as possible, kind of remove myself and just let them speak and not editorialize for them. That was very important to me.
But so I think one of the things that your book does as well is it gives credit to Deborah, his second wife, as the person who effectively leads him into Zen. I mean, their joint adventures in drug culture,
right,
at a time when that was very prevalent, admittedly, but she was the one who discovered Zen, and he went there in a way to expiate his guilt towards her. And I think your book really addresses that and honors that.
Well, I try to give credit to all the way. I mean, it's like his poor first wife, Patsy Southgate. You know, there's so many mythologies about the Paris Review and the men who founded the Paris Review. I mean, yeah, men did found the Paris Review, but Patsy was there in the kitchen making them lunch. So she also founded it then, as far as I'm concerned. Like, she was in the room, she was there, but she's never gotten any credit for that. And so, you know, I tried to sort of, you know, correct the record there a little bit as well. And he would never have been able to do what he did without Maria.
We should also mention, by the way, there is a brief but significant chapter in Australia. He came to Australia in a way on the same quest
the sharks.
As Zane Grey, which is that he was obsessed with white sharks, white pointers.
Yeah.
And so there is that Australian connection. There's a question over here from David, which I think might have to be the last one. Thank you.
Lance, it seems to me that Peter Matheson sort of represented a kind of traveller, a certain kind of traveller, you know, an explorer almost, you know, a person who travels in isolation, a deep thinker. You've travelled in his footsteps. I wonder if you could reflect on the nature of travel. I mean, is Peter Matheson's type of travel something that just doesn't exist anymore with our iPhones and our Google Maps and Instagramming everything? Can you just reflect on the nature of travel and how it's changed?
I mean, it's changed in the sense that he had institutional support from The New Yorker basically writing him blank checks to just go and do whatever he wanted, and that's all gone. Like, the golden age of magazines is gone. I also think it's changed just in the sense of, like, you know, there is a colonial aspect to his travel. Like, he was just this very privileged white man who would just go in and write about these places, and I think that's changed for the better, that you know, that now it's a multiplicity of voices. It's not just this one class of people able to kind of do all the travel writing. You do now get, you know, there is, in the US at least, there is a real movement of, you know, people of color doing nature and travel writing and things like that. And so I think that that's changed, and I'm, you know, I think that's great that's changed, but it is sad that, you know, the magazine support has gone. Yeah, I lament. I writing this book, there were certain moments where, you know, he's writing a letter to William Shawn at The New Yorker, and he's saying, I've decided I'm not going to go to Africa. I'm just going to stick around here for a couple of months. And he knew that he would just have permission to do that. He didn't even need to worry about it. And you know, if I did that today, I'd be fired. You know, yeah.
There's some lovely exchanges with William Shawn where you see Shawn's generosity as an editor. So, you know, when Peter decides he's not going to give him some material, and William Shawn says to him, "You do what's best
for your work." Yeah.
You know, he doesn't say, "But I commissioned that story. You owe it."
I know. There's no way David Remnick would do that. Yeah. Yeah. Like, you guys, he it was the Cayman Islands trip. So he goes and does this thing, and he says, "I'm going to write you a story, but I'm going to hold back the best material for my novel." And William Shawn says, "You do what's best for your work." And I guarantee that if you did that now, David Remnick would be like, "Excuse me." Like, you give us the best material that you can. Yeah, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
But
I looked at your Instagram feed, as one does these days, before one.
I need to lock it. I need to turn it private. Jesus.
And I discovered that you are a baker.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you, just in closing, whether there are any similarities between baking and biography.
I mean, I find baking more enjoyable, less like existentially torturous than writing is. Is there? I mean, they both take time.
Precision as well.
Precision, yeah.
It requires patience.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Precision.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Yeah. There's definitely a line there. I do like baking more, but I guess writing is a compulsion. So yeah.
So we've come to the end of this conversation. There's so many more things to talk about. This book is absolutely remarkable in terms of the complexity of the story it tells and the clarity that it brings, and elegance, because Lance is also a beautiful writer in his own right, to this extraordinary piece of work. Will you please join me now in thanking Lance? And he will, of course, be signing copies of his book. Once you've bought it over there, he will sign it over there. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.